The Trump tweets don't stop, but the Senate's work on health care certainly has. Maybe we can declare our independence from both this week on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. What better way to celebrate our nation's independence than to take a look back at some of our independent presidential candidates over the past half century?
For a third party to be successful, you need a strong, charismatic candidate. And I think you saw that with George Wallace, and you saw that with Ross Perot. I don't think Gary Johnson or Jill Stein had that ability.
Plus, a new book talks about the relationship between Dr. Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy, and how King pulled JFK into the civil rights struggle.
Kennedy tried to impress upon King that he knew the civil rights issues and he was going to move on the civil rights issues. He was being strongly influenced by the way that Dr. King comported himself, by his own moral authority.
And we'll recall how FDR tried to change the ideological balance of the judiciary with his court-packing scheme in 1937.
He had spent years considering his various options. That brought him around to an idea that had always been out there, but never taken that seriously, and that was to try to expand the Supreme Court from 9 justices to 15 overnight.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 186 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. With so much work that needs to be done, with health care and tax reform and infrastructure funding and everything else still up in the air, did we really need to spend most of the week focusing on another mean-spirited and childish tweet from the President of the United States? Apparently we did. We all know what he tweeted about Mika Brzezinski, the co-host of MSNBC's Morning Joe program. And depending on your perspective, it was a fair response by Trump, who has been often criticized and mocked on the show. Or it was beneath the dignity of the man holding the highest office in the land. If you ask Sarah Huckabee Sanders, a White House spokesperson, it was the former.
I think I've been pretty clear that when the president gets hit, he's going to hit back harder, which is what he did here today.
Doesn't he have to meet a higher standard than cable news anchors? Sarah, doesn't he have to meet a higher standard than cable news anchors?
Look, I don't think you can expect someone to be personally attacked day after day, minute by minute, and sit back. Look, the American people elected a fighter. They didn't elect somebody to sit back and do nothing. They knew what they were getting when they voted for Donald Trump, and he won overwhelmingly.
Yeah, overwhelmingly. If you're Brzezinski, you are sad.
I am very concerned as to what this once again reveals about the President of the United States. It's strange. The President's tweets, whether they're personally aimed at me or aimed at me in some way, that doesn't bother me one bit. It does worry me about the country. And I know we have Richard Haass with us. He appears to have a fragile, impetuous, childlike ego that we've seen over and over again, especially with women. It's like he can't take it. It is unbelievably alarming that this president is so easily played. He's so easily played by a cable news host. Now, what is that saying to our allies? What is that saying to our enemies? That this president is so easily played.
And what does it say about Trump and women? Let me give you one last thought about that bloody facelift tweet. Where have we heard this before? Was it with Megyn Kelly?
Ridiculous questions. And, you know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
Or his fixation on Hillary Clinton when, during a Democratic debate, she arrived back in the studio a little late after an extended bathroom break, and he said this.
What happened to her? I'm watching the debate, and she disappeared. Where did she go? Where did she go? I thought she quit. I thought she gave up. Where did she go? Where did Hillary go? They had to start the debate without her. Phase two. What? I know where she went. It's disgusting. I don't want to talk about it. No, it's too disgusting. Don't say it. It's disgusting. Let's not do it. We want to be very, very straight up, okay?
What is it about Trump and women? And even more important, why am I still asking that question? Well, at least Melania Trump is leading the campaign against cyberbullying, so there is that. And with this being a holiday week, we're not going to bully you into answering our current trivia question. We've decided to give you an additional week. And the question is, who was the last member of the House who lost his seat because of redistricting and later ran for president? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. The 4th of July holiday always reminds us of the battles and sacrifices we went through to get our independence. When it comes to the voting process, our history also shows that independence can be defined as an aversion to the two major parties, Democrats and Republicans. It's often expressed at the ballot box. And while independent candidates don't have a great track record at success, there are just two independents currently in the Senate, none in the House, not to mention failure at the presidential level. It's worth revisiting some of the independent and third-party White House hopefuls of the past half century. After all, this week was Independence Day. Ron Rappaport is a John Marshall Professor of Government at the College of William & Mary and an expert on independent and third-party candidates. He's the co-author of Three's a Crowd, The Dynamic of Third Parties. Ron, happy Independence Day, and welcome back to The Political Junkie.
I'm delighted to be back.
We're always told that a vote for a third party or independent candidate is a wasted vote since the odds are against them ever winning. And you know, and that's certainly true in presidential campaigns, and yet millions do every time. How come?
I think that when the third party identifies a set of issues that the major parties are not taking seriously or are very similar on, that then incentivizes the major parties to distinguish themselves more on that set of issues.
But let me go back to what happened in 2016, because both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton had the highest unfavorable polling numbers, I think, of any candidates in the history of polling. And, you know, and yes, Gary Johnson did better than any libertarian candidate in history. I think he got like 4.5 million votes, more than 3% of the vote. Jill Stein of the Green Party got about 1.5 million votes. But if the dissatisfaction with Trump and Clinton was so great, and polls show that it was, why weren't their numbers stronger? Why wasn't there a larger protest vote?
Right. Well, I think that the incentive that you talk about to not waste your vote is really important. And I think that, people tend to vote for third parties in large numbers only when that third party has really identified a set of issues and has a charismatic leader to, in a sense, sell that agenda. And I think you saw that with George Wallace, and you saw that with Ross Perot. I don't think Gary Johnson or Jill Stein had that ability. So I think that, you know, aside from the fact they didn't have the resources, I think even with the resources, they would not have been able to sort of pull this off. So I think that you really do need, for a third party to be successful, you need the candidate, and it has to be a strong, charismatic candidate. And on top of that, I think you need a sort of distinctive issue agenda. And I don't think either of them really offered that in any kind of meaningful way.
You know, I think that's an absolutely fair critique, plus the fact that neither one was allowed in any of the debates, and that didn't help their cause either.
Well, that's right. And I think Ross Perot being in the debates in 1992 was probably the most significant reason for his success. Right. I mean, that he was able to hold on to his voters as well as he did, because he performed quite well in the debates and it put him on a level with them.
Let me just go back even more recently to the present and talk about the discrepancy between the number of votes Ralph Nader got and the effect he had on the 2000 election. And the reason I'm saying, you know, Nader has argued from the beginning that he saw no difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush. Let me play a piece of tape. This is Nader on Fox News in 2000 with a question thrown in the middle by Fred Barnes.
Well, because on corporate power issues, which I think are central in this country, and the takeover of the political government by the corporate government, the only difference between Al Gore and George Bush is the velocity with which his forehead hits the floor when big business knocks on the door.
So would the Democratic Party be better off if Gore loses, even if Bush wins?
Doesn't mean much difference at all.
I mean, Ron, basically, he saw absolutely no difference between Bush and Gore.
Right. Well, I think there's always the incentive of the third party to say that. And George Wallace is known for the line, it's not a dime's worth of difference. I think that's not always true. It may be on particular issues, the parties don't differ much. But overall, they certainly do. And, you know, one thing I'd say about Nader is I think that we overrate his success, right? It was an exquisitely close election that any number of things could have affected. And I think it wasn't that he got so many votes. It was that the election was so close.
Before we get rid of Ralph Nader altogether, remember, Democrats continue to blame him for Gore's defeat in Florida. Gore lost to Bush by 537 votes, as Nader was getting 97,000 votes. But Nader says, well, look, you know, hundreds of thousands of Democrats in Florida voted for Bush, and Gore couldn't even win his home state of Tennessee, so why are you blaming me? What's your ultimate judgment of Nader's candidacy?
Well, my judgment is that, you know, when he talked about the Gore and Bush being identical, that was pretty specious. I guess I really think Gore should have won that election easily. It shouldn't have come down to 500 votes. I think Gore ran really one of the worst campaigns I've seen. It was not as bad as the Clinton campaign this time, probably, but it was a really terrible campaign. So I think if Nader had not run, I do think Gore would have won. I think there are a variety of other things Gore could have done to ensure that he won, like using Bill Clinton more, emphasizing how good the economy was instead of running a more populist campaign like he did. So, you know, Nader is partly at fault, but I think Gore is more at fault than Nader for that election outcome.
You mentioned this guy earlier. We heard from him in 1992, and to a lesser extent, we heard from him in 1996, but we heard from this guy a lot during those years.
If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for labor, hire a young 25, let's assume you've been in business for a long time, you've got a mature workforce. Pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south. So if the people send me to Washington, the first thing I'll do is study that 2,000-page agreement and make sure it's a two-way street.
Roth Perot seems to be the ideal candidate you talked about. He was not far to the right, far to the left. He just appealed to a lot of people who were just dissatisfied by the state of the economy.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it's an interesting thing because the supporters of Perot, we did a fair amount of survey work with Perot supporters. They both favored raising taxes and cutting services. They were really serious about balancing the budget, whereas I think frequently what you see on the Republican side is they want to simply cut benefits, and on the Democratic side, you know, just simply raise taxes. So I think Perot on areas of the deficit, economic nationalism, of which NAFTA was certainly a part, and, you know, just reform, transparency, openness had lots and lots of appeal. And I think he picked three areas that the major parties were not credible on. I don't think either party was credible on the budget, on the deficit. Neither was credible on reform. And they really, you know, in many ways, both parties really agreed on NAFTA. Certainly Clinton and Bush really did. So I think that Perot was able to see that opportunity, to see that opening, and put together this set of issues that really distinguished him from the two major parties.
It seems like whenever a third party or independent candidate runs, we talk less about how he or she is going to do and more about who he or she is going to hurt the most or the least.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the evidence is that Perot drew pretty much equally on Election Day in the exit polls. Perot voters split pretty much evenly between Bush and Clinton. And I think that on the other hand, if you looked at Ralph Nader, if they had not voted by who their second choice, it would have been very heavily Gore over Bush.
If they voted at all.
Right, if they voted at all. So if you look at the ones who did vote and ask them, who's your second choice, Gore leads Bush by quite a bit. And so then you can say, okay, he wasn't there, Gore would have won. But again, I think, you know, Gore has to take significant blame for this.
One of the problems we always say about independent candidates is that they're either poorly funded or they don't get in debates. But in 92, Perot spent, and this was astounding at the time, he spent $60 million on his campaign. He made it into the debates. He got 19 million votes, which I think was like 19% of the vote, which was incredible. And yet the total number of electoral votes, zero. So if you have all that money, all that exposure, you're in the debate, and you still can't get close to a victory, what's the point?
I think it is really very difficult for a third-party candidate to win. I was rerunning in my own mind 2016 with Ross Perot as a third-party candidate. 2016, I think, was even better set up than 92, because I think you would have had both the unpopularity and the sort of innovative issue sets. But yeah, you are right. I mean, it's almost impossible. It requires a real sort of turning away from both parties over a longer period of time. So I think they're, you know, often third-party candidates run because they care a lot about specific issues. But I think in some cases, they do run to win. I think that George Wallace had the best strategy, which was because he was a regional candidate. So regional candidates do win electoral votes. Strom Thurmond won multiple states while he only got 2% of the vote, whereas Ross Perot gets 19% of the vote and gets no states. But George Wallace's plan was to get enough votes to prevent either of the major party candidates from winning the Electoral College and then to bargain with them. I think he even thought he might be able to convince each of them that he was better than the other of them. And so that it was not inconceivable in his mind, at least, that he could have actually gotten the win in the Electoral College because of the bargaining that would occur before the Electoral College votes were actually cast. But regional parties are always advantaged as third parties.
Well, let me play a campaign commercial for George Wallace from 68.
Why are more and more millions of Americans turning to Governor Wallace? Follow as your children are bussed across town.
As president, I shall, within the law, turn back the absolute control of the public school systems to the people of the respective states.
Why are more and more millions of Americans turning to Governor Wallace? Open a little business and see what might happen.
As president, I will stand up for your local police and firemen in protecting your safety and property.
Why are more and more millions of Americans turning to Governor Wallace? Watch your hard-earned tax dollars sail away to anti-American countries.
As president, I will halt the giveaway of your American dollars and products to those nations that aid our enemies.
Wallace has the courage to stand up for America. Give him your support.
You know, Ron, compared to everybody we've talked about in the past, you know, during the early part of this interview, Wallace was the only one who carried any state. He carried five states in the Deep South. Would you say his campaign was a success? Would you argue that he can't hurt one candidate more than the other? What do you think?
Well, I think his voters actually would have been Nixon voters disproportionately. I don't think he altered the outcome. His supporters were Democrats to a significant degree, but they were Southern Democrats. So I think that he really made this appeal very much on race. I think he was expected to do even better. The labor movement really kicked into high gear in the Midwest, where Wallace had a lot of support. But again, it was a national campaign, but with a real regional sort of emphasis. And again, regional campaigns can win electoral votes, even with relatively small percentages of the electorate. Wallace did have a pretty good, you know, percentage of the electorate, But by being regional, he won multiple states.
I was going to say that a lot of, it seems like during, if you look at the polling of these independent candidates around Labor Day, their numbers are really pretty high. But as we get closer to Election Day, I guess maybe reality sets in or whatever, but those numbers go down drastically.
Right. I mean, Perot's a sort of exception there because, of course, he had dropped out. And then when he came back, he was somewhat lower. And then he actually increased and did not decline at the very end. In fact, I think he would have gone up more if he hadn't had the interview on 60 Minutes where he talked about what the Republicans disrupting his daughter's wedding and you know, some crazy sorts of things. You know, I think that Wallace was really the victim of a very strong counterattack, especially by labor, but by Democrats. And I think that, you know, diminished his, especially because the election looked to be so close. You know, Humphrey was gaining and gaining and gaining. And I think in a close election, I would expect third-party support to decline. In an election which is not, you'd expect third-party, you know, people can then vote for whom they wish.
Let me close this by asking a question that I'm sure you could not possibly answer. But I was just thinking of this. When does the anger and dissatisfaction in this country get so bad that an independent candidate has a shot?
That really is a good question, right? I mean, third parties only emerge when there's a rejection of the two major parties. But you also need that third-party candidate. And there was an awful lot of anger in 1992. You'd had the House banking scandal. You'd had a lot of stuff going on. And both Bush and Clinton were quite unpopular early on. That allowed Perot an opening. But as you said, and make the very good point, Perot still got less than 20% of the vote and carried no electoral votes. So I suspect you're going to continue to have a lot of dissatisfaction and alienation and sort of negativity. But I don't think that necessarily means that a third party is going to emerge with the sort of support that would allow it to win an election.
Ron Rappaport is the John Marshall Professor of Government at the College of William and Mary. He's also an expert on independent and third-party candidates. Ron, thanks for being on the program, and happy Independence Day.
Well, happy Independence Day to you too, Ken. Thanks a lot.
Anyone who knows anything about the history of civil rights is familiar with the dynamic between President Lyndon Johnson and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The 2014 movie Selma and the 2016 HBO film All the Way focused on the Freedom March led by King, John Lewis, and others, and the movement's interaction with LBJ, a Southerner who became president in 1963 following the assassination of John F. Kennedy. There are countless books about how Johnson worked with King, for better or worse, to push through the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and other legislation that Congress had long resisted. It's a gripping story, one that played a monumental role in the fight for freedom for African Americans, a battle that continues to this day. Less known is the relationship between Kennedy and King. Civil rights was not a top issue in the 1960 campaign that elected JFK, nor did he push the issue as a candidate, especially as he worked to get the support of segregationist Southern governors. But between his election and his assassination, Kennedy changed in his attitude and actions regarding civil rights. And an excellent new book chronicles it all. It's called Kennedy and King, The President, the Pastor, and the Battle Over Civil Rights. The author is Stephen Levingston, and he is the nonfiction book editor at The Washington Post. And, even better, he's here on The Political Junkie. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I want to tell you, this is a superb book. So much of the information I found in it is not well known, but I think anyone who wants to learn about the fight for civil rights in this country, this is the one to read.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's great to hear that. I think you're right. As you mentioned earlier, it is sort of less known than the Johnson years in civil rights, partly because it was a little bit more underground in a sense and during the Kennedy administration. Kennedy tried to keep it a little bit underground. He was more concerned with law and order than he was really with trying to push the real civil rights movement. And whenever he made a small step forward, he would make several steps backward. And what I tried to show in the book really was how these men who were engaged in this very hard early struggle over civil rights took the steps that they did from the ground level. We've had a lot of histories about civil rights from many miles up, historians looking down. But what was most interesting to me is to see how these characters sort of dealt with each other on a day-to-day basis, how they dealt with the crises on a day-to-day basis, and how it played out in the nitty-gritty, very highly detailed way that we sometimes miss in some other books.
Even before we get to Kennedy getting to the White House, I mean, we all know that, you know, Harry Truman broke the color barrier with the armed services. We know that Eisenhower didn't push the issue during the 1950s, and I think most agree that the Civil Rights Act of 1957 was not the toughest piece of legislation ever written, but it was probably as strong as the Southern-dominated Congress was going to get. And Kennedy himself, who's a senator from Massachusetts, he was not, you know, he was not known for going to the mat on civil rights, certainly not like, you could say, Hubert Humphrey, the way Hubert Humphrey was. So I guess my question is, how would you describe Senator Kennedy's views on civil rights and the actions he took in the 1950s? Let's start off with that.
Well, he wasn't really a civil rights guy from early on. He would look at civil rights, but he, again, sort of had larger issues in mind. He was always interested in foreign affairs, and he was interested more in domestic issues. And he put civil rights really into the background and dealt with it only in the safest possible ways. There were times when, you know, he would come out in favor of black veterans who were back home from overseas, and there was a memorial being dedicated to him. He would get out there and be there for the dedication. But beyond things like that, he really didn't do all of that much. And as he was preparing to run for the presidency, he knew that he needed the Southern Democrats and the Southern voters to come to him. So he was very careful about how far he would go on civil rights, and he even friended a lot of very powerful Southern senators and Southern governors who were quite racist in their views.
Yeah, I was just thinking in his battle for the nomination, some of the people he reached out to the most, I think of the people like John Patterson in Alabama, Orville Faubus in Arkansas. I mean, these were segregationists who Kennedy had no problem, you know, being allies with.
Exactly. And there were blacks, prominent blacks like Jackie Robinson, who were vehemently opposed to him showing any sort of friendship with Patterson. Patterson and Kennedy had a sort of a private soiree or a meal in Washington. And Patterson emerged before the election saying that he could be a friend of Kennedy and Kennedy could be a friend of his. And, you know, for somebody like Jackie Robinson and for other blacks, that sort of rubbed everybody the wrong way.
I think, if I recall correctly, Jackie Robinson was for the longest time a Republican. And I wonder if, and I'm skipping ahead of myself a little bit, but when I think of when candidate John F. Kennedy interceded when Dr. King was arrested, was in jail in Atlanta, and Richard Nixon did not do the same, it seemed like that almost began the beginning of the odyssey of Kennedy towards civil rights implementation.
Oh, it certainly did. I mean, that was the situation where King was in prison. He had been locked up after participating in a sit-in in Atlanta. And it was a few weeks before the election. And the candidates really had to speak out or not. And there was pressure on them. Nixon, to his detriment, remained silent. He just gave a no comment through his press secretary. But Kennedy famously decided to call Coretta King and express his compassion for her and his concern about her situation and her husband's situation. And pressure soon began to bear on the judge, and King was soon released from prison. This caused a cascade of enthusiasm for Kennedy. Blacks who had never really considered him before, even Martin Luther King's own father, who was ready to vote for Nixon because he was suspicious of Kennedy's Catholicism, decided that he could vote for Kennedy in this case now. I think the quote was something like, you know, I can vote for Kennedy, Catholic or whatever he is. And this was supplemented by many other blacks who just swarmed to Kennedy. And in the end, he took the election by a very slim margin. But the margins in certain black communities were huge.
You know, I don't mean to sound cynical, but as I was reading your book, I had this sense, or maybe this is just something I'm still wrestling with, that the way I saw it, yes, Kennedy cared about civil rights, but he was also very aware of how it would all affect his political future. So he was sympathetic, but also calculating at the same time. Would you say that's fair?
Oh, I think that's entirely fair. What I've tried to do, though, is to look a little bit beyond the calculation and to try to get inside the man's soul, if I could even say that. It's a hard thing to do for any person, much less someone like him, because he didn't display much. But I try to look at the various instances in his life that were sort of like turning him a little bit toward having a true conscience and a true sense of knowing that we needed a kind of a moral necessity on civil rights. And I think that, you know, part of the theme of the book was that he was being strongly influenced by the way that Dr. King comported himself, by what he said, by his own moral authority. And over time, that sort of played on Kennedy in a way that, in the end, as we all know, in June of 1963, he came out and said that civil rights was a moral issue, and he was going to introduce legislation to deal with the issue of segregation.
We face, therefore, a moral crisis as a country and a people. It cannot be met by repressive police action. It cannot be left to increased demonstrations in the streets. It cannot be quieted by token moves or talk. It is a time to act in the Congress, in your state and local legislative body, and above all, in all of our daily lives. It is not enough to pin the blame on others, to say this is a problem of one section of the country or another, or deplore the facts that we face. A great change is at hand, and our task, our obligation, is to make that revolution, that change, peaceful and constructive for all. Those who do nothing are inviting shame as well as violence. Those who act boldly are recognizing right as well as reality.
Now, that's what he said in 1963, but your book also talks about the Kennedy and King's first meeting in 1960, which almost was in secret, and apparently that meeting didn't go so well. Describe that.
No, it didn't. And this was the time when Kennedy was still a bit of a novice in understanding the civil rights movement. And he believed that the way to win black voters was to win black leaders, which has been sort of discounted over the years. And I don't think people really believe it, but he wanted King to endorse him, which King never did, never would in any presidential race, because he would lose his unbiased position and he would lose his strength in a sense. But they had this meeting, and Kennedy tried to impress upon King that he knew the civil rights issues and he was going to move on the civil rights issues, but King wasn't that impressed. He came away feeling that Kennedy was a smart guy, he had a potential to learn, but he really wasn't up to speed on what he needed to be with the civil rights movement, and he wasn't sure how much he could really trust him.
And then as president, as you said, you talked about the speech in June of 63, but as president, you know, Kennedy certainly watched the police dogs and the fire hoses and the bombings and the assassination of Medgar Evers. And actually 2 months before his own death, before Kennedy's own death, it was the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, horrific bombing in Birmingham. All of this affected him. I think the greatest part about your book, and I think that the part that moved me the most, was that how we watched Kennedy become a changed man with all of this.
Yeah, as I did the research, that's what I came upon, and that's what I understood about the man. And if you read a lot about him and you read about what other people who have had experiences with him will say, they'll say that he had a tremendous capacity for growth. And if you're a friendly person, an optimistic person, a generous person, you have to stop and ask yourself, what does that mean? And how does someone grow? And how would it affect him in this particular situation? And so I tried hard to sort of trace what were those moments of growth, even though, as we all do, we want to become better, we grow, and then we regress and we grow. This is sort of the pattern that Kennedy exhibited. And in the end, I firmly believe that he was a guy who had finally sort of was able to stand in the shoes as much as he could of a black person and feel what it was like to be black in America at that time. And that empathy is really where he arrived. And that's the sort of thing that his brother also was very conscious of, that the two of them together sort of arrived at this state of empathy and were able through that to develop a compassion and a conscience to say to themselves and say to the nation that we had to take dramatic action on civil rights.
You know, we're spending all this time talking about Kennedy and, of course, the outsized role that Bobby Kennedy played as well, as your book describes. But we're not talking much about King. How would you describe the role King played, the influence King had in the evolution of Kennedy's views on race and civil rights?
Well, as I sort of mentioned earlier, it was really a moral authority, I think, that King exerted. And on top of that, it was just his persistence and his determination and the way that he sort of communicated what was on the ground in the movement at the time, that civil rights progress was moving too slowly, that people were being treated inappropriately and intolerably. You know, there was a time when he was sort of losing a little bit of his grip on the leadership of the movement as younger people moved in and wanted him to move faster. And sort of what I found a little bit interesting in this and what I tried to convey in the book is that while King was having an impact on Kennedy, Kennedy's dilly-dallying and dithering was having an impact on King in the way that he managed the movement. So that he was a guy, as we all know, who believed in nonviolent protest and to take things a little bit more measured. But as things progressed and Kennedy hesitated and continued to hesitate, King realized that he had to step up his game a little bit. He had to sort of be a little bit more aggressive in how he pushed the movement forward. And we saw that in Birmingham, where he, you know, was considered not to go out and march and get himself arrested, but he finally decided he would do that. And then he also agreed to have children march in Birmingham, which was a very big decision. It was very scary for parents and for everybody in the community, and he got a lot of heat for it. But they agreed to have children march because what was any of this for except children? And young people had always been at the forefront of protest in his view. And he believed that the police, as nasty as they were not going to beat up on little children. But it would get a lot of press. It would move the movement forward. And it may have a really positive impact on Kennedy and on getting something done.
You know, so much of what I always think of Kennedy, what we all think of Kennedy is those what ifs. What if he hadn't been gunned down? What if he had, you know, been reelected in 1964? And we know that Lyndon Johnson, with his own great arm twisting skills, pushed Congress in 64 and 65 on civil rights bills. I know there's no way of actually fully answering this question, but in your view, do you think that had Kennedy lived and been reelected and there's no guarantee he would have been even reelected, but would Kennedy have been able to do what Johnson accomplished?
That's really the big question. I mean, and I hear that question a lot. And it's a hard one to answer because, as we know, Kennedy was not as adept with managing Congress, getting things moving through Congress as Johnson was. And in some ways, fate worked out in a horrible way that possibly made the civil rights movement push forward in a more direct way by having Johnson being the man at the helm, because he knew how to do it and he could twist the arms and he knew how to work with Congress. I mean, there's any number of scenarios you could come up with if Kennedy had lived and what would have happened with the civil rights movement as well as many other things. But I mean, it's just so hard to speculate. I suppose if Johnson were put out there as the main person who was leading the charge on civil rights in Congress, maybe he could have done it that way. He liked to use surrogates. He used Bobby as a surrogate. He could use Johnson as a surrogate if Johnson would do it. But it's really hard to speculate.
Yeah, I was thinking because, I mean, I just can picture Johnson using the assassination and using the legacy of Kennedy to make his case before Congress for civil rights.
Oh, he did. And that was it was his first speech, basically, after he became president, was to say that we had to continue this effort that John Kennedy began on civil rights. And that was really important. So Johnson had fully embraced it, which was kind of wonderful.
Stephen Levingston is the author of a great and valuable new book, Kennedy and King, The President, the Pastor, and the Battle Over Civil Rights. Stephen, it was great having you on the program.
Well, thanks so much. It was great talking with you.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land, I'd
my brothers and my sisters all over this land.
It's time for This Week in Political History. In 2004, John Kerry pretty much had the Democratic presidential nomination locked up early. He won the caucuses in Iowa, the primary in New Hampshire, and one by one, his challengers dropped out of the race. Dick Gephardt, Joe Lieberman, Wesley Clark, Howard Dean. The last one to quit, John Edwards.
Today, I've decided to suspend my campaign for the presidency of the United States, but I want to say a word about a man who is a friend of mine, somebody who I believe has great strength and great courage, my friend Senator John Kerry, somebody who has fought for and will continue to fight for the things that all of us believe in: more jobs, better health care, cleaner air, cleaner water, a safer world. The truth is, all these, they are the causes of our party, the Democratic Party. They are the causes of America, and they are the reasons we will prevail come November and take back this country.
Edwards won only two primaries, in North and South Carolina. But he showed strong campaigning charm and was seen as an inspiring orator. And he immediately topped the list of potential Kerry running mates. But when he was asked about his interest in joining the ticket, he always had the same response.
I'm absolutely not interested in being vice president. No, the answer to that question is no.
That all changed 13 years ago this week at a rally in Pittsburgh.
I have chosen a man who understands and defends the values of America, a man who has shown courage and conviction as a champion for middle-class Americans and for those struggling to reach the middle class, a man who has shown guts and determination and political skill in his own race for the presidency of the United States, a man whose life has prepared him for leadership, and whose character brings him to exercise it. I am pleased to announce that with your help, the next Vice President of the United States of America will be Senator John Edwards from North Carolina.
Bob Shrum was a senior advisor to the Kerry campaign and joins us to talk about the decision to name John Edwards as Kerry's running mate. Bob, it's great to have you on the Political Junkie.
Glad to be here.
I know people have a different opinion about Edwards in light of things he did in his personal life, the betrayal of his wife, all those things that happened after 2004. But I'm not here to discuss those things and certainly not defend them. I want to keep this conversation focused on 2004 and not 2007, 2008. But anyway, so tell me about the decision to pick Edwards as the running mate. What were you hoping he would bring to the ticket?
Well, that decision was ultimately made by Senator Kerry, but I certainly was supportive of it. There was a very strong feeling among Democrats in some of the polling that we did that Edwards should be the vice presidential nominee. He had captured people's imagination. We thought he would be an excellent debater against Dick Cheney. Joe Lieberman had been killed by Cheney in the debate 4 years before. He turned out not to be such an excellent debater, but we thought he would be. And there was just this general feeling in the party that he should be chosen. In retrospect, and it has nothing to do with what happened in years to come, I think we would have been better off if we had picked Dick Gephardt. Now, the odd thing is that in some polling that we did in Missouri, Edwards was marginally more popular than Gephardt. And nationally, he was certainly more popular, or more the choice of Democrats than Gephardt was. But if you think about that race and how it played out, I would love to have had Dick Gephardt on the ticket in Ohio. I would also love to have had him in that debate.
I was going to ask you that same thing. There was some talk that maybe Edwards would help in the South, but I can't see anybody taking states away from Bush and Cheney in the South. But in the industrial Midwest, perhaps Gephardt would have been a much stronger candidate.
I think he would have been, although the polling didn't show that. But it's proof that at times you should just ignore the polling. I mean, I think as the campaign wore on, if you deployed Gephardt in places like Ohio, he would have been a very powerful force, just as, for example, Joe Biden was in Pennsylvania and Ohio in 2008. So I think he would have had a real appeal, and I think we probably should have picked him. That's easy to say. In retrospect, at the time, a lot of the signals pointed toward Edwards.
Earlier, I played a piece of tape of Edwards saying he was definitely not interested in being vice president, but by most accounts, he was seriously campaigning for the job.
I believe he was seriously campaigning for the job. I believe he was interested, and I think he thought it was very important to his political viability and future that he be selected as vice president.
I know Kerry and Edwards were rivals for the nomination that year, but I've read there was some personal tension between the two, even after Edwards dropped out of the race. Was there any story behind that?
Well, I don't think there was personal tension between the two. I do think that Senator Kerry found his first long discussion with Senator Edwards unsettling and had to go back and have a second conversation before he could settle on Senator Edwards. One thing I will say, someone whose judgment was, in my view, quite correct about this was Teresa Hines, Senator Kerry's wife, who was opposed to the choice and would certainly have favored Gephardt.
Were there people in the Kerry campaign who felt there was a lack of personal chemistry between the two?
No, actually, in public, their chemistry was fine. And, you know, for much of the campaign, I think they got along fine. Edwards, as I said, did not do what we thought he could do in that debate, number one. And number two, he was always pretty unwilling to go out there and really go after Cheney and Bush in tough ways. My own view now, in retrospect, is that he was thinking about his future, thinking about the fact that he, if they didn't win, he could run in 2008, even though he had told Kerry during their discussions that if they didn't win and Kerry wanted to run, he, Edwards, would not run.
What's your own view about the importance of a VP pick?
It can be critical. I don't buy this conventional wisdom that it doesn't matter. I think, obviously, the Kennedy pick of Johnson was absolutely critical. But I also think Reagan's pick of Bush was reassuring to people, because we all forget this, but the first Bush was seen as a kind of moderate Republican. And I think that was something that sent a message that Reagan was not a hardline conservative. And, you know, I think you could go down a whole list of these things. I think Al Gore was an inspired pick by Bill Clinton, and I think it helped Bill Clinton win a lot of those southern states.
But you could also make the case that Geraldine Ferraro, while it, you know, she brought tears of joy in 1984, but the ticket lost 49 states, and Dan Quayle was repeatedly mocked, but the Bush-Quayle ticket carried 40 out of 50 states, so...
Well, I'd say two things about that. First, it wouldn't have mattered who Walter Mondale ran with in 1984. He was not going to defeat Ronald Reagan. It was not going to happen. And with respect to the second, I think you have to give at least a little bit of the blame or credit for what happened in that to the fact that Dukakis, until the last two or three weeks, ran a kind of quiescent, hide in the weeds, don't go out there with any strong message kind of campaign.
Okay, well, having said that, how would you assess Edwards' performance as Kerry's running mate? You said you were not as good in the debate and not as strong charging against the Bush-Cheney team, but as a campaigner, what do you think?
Well, I think he's very good at giving a speech, and he could be. I mean, I did his campaign for the Senate in 1998. He's a very smart guy, but I think he was reluctant to go out there and be the point man against Bush and Cheney. And frankly, he did not perform well in that debate. And I was worried about whether he was going to perform well in that debate when I went from Kerry debate prep to one day of a John Edwards debate prep. And he wasn't ready, nor was he confident. And, you know, he didn't get killed the way, in my view, Lieberman got killed in 2000 by Dick Cheney, who went into that debate in 2000 the most unpopular of the four candidates and came out as the most popular. But he didn't do much in that debate. He didn't really make much ground against Cheney, and you could argue that Cheney made some ground against him. I mean, that's what, look, with the vice presidential candidate in the modern system, there are two big things they can do. One is carry a state, and the other is do very well in the debate, along with, acting as a point man. Now, we did not think we were going to carry North Carolina. He was not picked for that reason. We did not think we were going to carry a lot of southern states. He was not picked for that reason. But you would have hoped that he would have done better in that debate and that he would have been willing to be out there more on the front lines going after President Bush and Cheney.
Bob Schrum is a veteran Democratic strategist who was a top consultant to John Kerry's 2004 presidential bid. He's associated with the University of Southern California's politics department, and he's on Twitter at Bob Schrum. Bob, it was great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken.
It was 13 years ago this week, on July 6, 2004, that John Kerry chose his fellow senator and former rival, John Edwards, as his running mate. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
You cheated, you lied, you said that you want me. You cheated, you lied, you said that you love me.
The scorecard for President Trump during his first 5 months in office is incomplete. Certainly, as of now, he gets a failing grade for his inability to have an Obamacare repeal bill passed or even written. But one thing does rate as an unqualified success: his nomination and confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. Compare that to the failure of President Obama in his final year in office to get a vote, let alone a committee hearing, for Judge Merrick Garland to succeed the late Antonin Scalia. The inability of Obama to get his court nominee taken up by Mitch McConnell and the Republicans remains a sore subject among Democrats. In that sense, it's hard to feel any pity for Franklin D. Roosevelt. During his 12 years plus as the nation's 32nd president, Roosevelt named 8 justices to the Supreme Court and elevated another as chief justice. All total, they served a combined 146 years on the court. But early in his tenure, after he won a landslide re-election in 1936, he found himself frustrated by a conservative court that deemed several of his key initiatives unconstitutional. Well, he had a solution. He would change the makeup of the Supreme Court itself. With the justices, in his opinion, too old and outdated, he would fix things by expanding the court. Here's President Roosevelt from one of his fireside chats.
A new member shall be appointed by the president then in office with the approval, as required by the Constitution, of the Senate of the United States. That plan has 2 chief purposes. By bringing into the judicial system a steady and continuing stream of new and younger blood, I hope first to make the administration of all federal justice, from the bottom to the top, speedier and therefore less costly. Secondly, to bring to the decision of social and economic problems younger men who have had personal experience and contact with modern facts and circumstances under which average men have to live and work. This plan will save our national constitution from hardening of the judicial arteries.
In other words, he would nominate a new justice for every justice already on the court with 10 years of service, age 70 or older, up to a total of 15 Supreme Court justices. All it would take to make it happen was for Congress to pass the legislation. Jeff Schessel is the author of an outstanding book on the whole affair. It's called Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court. And he's here to remind us of what happened during FDR's famous, or infamous, attempt to pack the court with liberal justices who agreed with him. Jeff Schessel, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
There are many stories of what presidents have done to get their people onto the Supreme Court. A few months ago, we had somebody talking on this show talking about President Nixon and the Haynesworth and Carswell nominations. But what FDR did is just mind-boggling. Walk us through it.
It is mind-boggling, and that's the reason I decided I wanted to spend some years studying it and ultimately writing a book about it. It never made sense to me why this brilliant politician, who was described at the time by one magazine as the most brilliant politician ever to inhabit a human skin, how he could so misjudge the Congress, how he could so misjudge the country, and to do something that sounds to us and sounded to them at the time so radical as to try to expand the Supreme Court from 9 justices to 15 overnight, as you described. And so I wanted to kind of get into his decision-making process, see what he felt that he was up against, look at what the court was doing at the time, and not to in any way justify the decision that he made, but just to understand it. And the story really begins even before he has taken the oath of office as president. The Supreme Court at that time was a strongly conservative institution and had been for most of the previous 50 years. There was a lot of terrific progressive legislation banning child labor, for example, that had gone to the Supreme Court and died there. So progressives, liberals in the country were deeply frustrated. And Roosevelt, as he was developing his New Deal and waiting those months before he took office, he began to have conversations with his advisors about what to do about the Supreme Court. He could see that a collision was going to come. And it was a question of how soon it would happen and what the flashpoints would be, but he knew that it was going to come. And so that discussion started in earnest even before Inauguration Day.
And then it was after his reelection in 36, and actually it was a landslide election. I read he only lost Maine and Vermont. And I'm wondering if maybe given such a landslide like that, he felt he just had the power and the authority and the motivation to push this through.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it was one of the great landslides in American history. Not only did Roosevelt win a personal victory on a colossal scale, but the Democrats were the most dominant political party that had been seen in the country since the Republican domination of the Reconstruction era. And he felt that it was time finally to do something. But taking a couple of steps back, you have to follow him through his first term and all of the legislation of the famous 100 days, all the legislation that followed that, all of the changes that were starting to take root in the country, the extremely tentative recovery despite massive unemployment numbers that lasted through that first term of his presidency. And that confrontation that I mentioned that he saw coming at the beginning really started to hit at the beginning of 1935 when the Supreme Court, so 2 years into Roosevelt's first term, the Supreme Court finally starts to knock down New Deal programs. And the Republican press in the country cheers. One newspaper, when the first decision came down in early 35, said, it's time to throw this revolutionary nonsense in the Potomac where it belongs. And so we began then a pitched ideological battle between the president and the New Dealers and most of the country, which was on his side, and an increasingly defiant conservative opposition, businesses as well as the Republicans in Congress. And then the Supreme Court finally takes up the charge and begins, as I said, to knock down not just executive actions here or there, but really the central pillars of the New Deal. The National Recovery Administration, the Blue Eagle that you would see in the 30s in shop windows and at the top of newspaper mastheads that said this company, whatever it was, followed these voluntary regulations in terms of wages and working hours and so forth. They knocked that down in 1935. In 1936, they knocked down the AAA, the agricultural program. And everybody felt on both sides that Social Security would be next, that the National Labor Relations Act would be next. Really, the whole thing was being knocked down to ruins. And Roosevelt, among others, really began to fear a total economic collapse that would make the Depression look like a cakewalk.
You mentioned that the Republicans were opposed to him, and of course, after the 36 election, certainly after the 32 election, but even more so after 36, there wasn't much of a Republican Party in Congress to speak of. But even among Roosevelt's fellow Democrats, there was strong opposition to do what he was doing regarding the court.
That's right. So that brings us to the court packing plan. And you mentioned that he was sort of feeling his oats politically after his landslide reelection in 1936. And it was really at that point that he decided, right after the election, in the fall of 36, he decides, I've got to do something about the Supreme Court. Not a single justice had left the court or died during the first term. It looked like, as old as these guys were, they were known as the nine old men. It looked like none of them were going anywhere. And he felt that the situation was getting quite desperate. He felt that he had the strength to act, and he needed to do something. He had spent years, and I do mean 2-3 years, considering his various options, amending the Constitution possibly to impose term limits on Supreme Court justices or age limits or to take certain kinds of cases out of their jurisdiction so that they couldn't knock down these economic programs and so forth. But ultimately, Roosevelt felt there was no problem with the Constitution. The problem was the way these justices were interpreting the Constitution. The judges were the problem, not the Constitution. And so that brought him around to an idea that had always been out there but never taken that seriously, and that was packing the court. It was perfectly constitutional. As you said, all you had to do was pass a bill in Congress. This could happen tomorrow. Congress could pass a bill increasing the size of the Supreme Court from 9 to 23, and President Trump could sign the bill, and there we would have it. This is perfectly constitutional, and Roosevelt felt that he had gotten almost everything he wanted out of this Congress. He would get this. He would solve the problem virtually overnight. But as you said, even Democrats were uneasy about this for a range of reasons.
Well, I'm going to play some archival tape that was part of a PBS American Experience show on the subject. You're going to hear from Senator Frederick Van Nuys, a Democrat from Indiana, a Democratic Congressman Samuel Pettengill, also from Indiana, and Senator Arthur Vandenberg, a Michigan Republican.
I shall not be a party to breaking down the checks and balances of the Constitution.
A packed jury, a packed court, and a stuffed ballot box are all on the same moral plane. This is more power than a good man should want or a bad man should have.
This is a nonpartisan battle to preserve an independent Supreme Court.
There was large opposition in Congress, wasn't there?
There absolutely was. There was a lot of concern, even among Roosevelt supporters, even among New Dealers, that the lines of criticism that you just heard from those members of Congress were exactly right. That even though the size of the Supreme Court had changed a number of times over the course of the previous century, it had gone up and down, sometimes for political reasons during the 19th century, it had settled where it was at 9 way back in 1869. So there were very few people around who even could remember that it had ever been anything other than 9. And many liberals and progressives felt that if you created the precedent that a president who didn't like decisions of the Supreme Court could just pass a bill changing the size of the court, even if they liked Roosevelt and the sort of justices he would pick, they felt that this would be abused by future presidents. There were a lot of different concerns, and good liberals and progressives also felt that it created, at the very least, the impression and possibly the reality of executive domination of the Supreme Court and an end to the independence of the judiciary. And so the liberals generally fell in line out of loyalty to Roosevelt or a certain fear or a desire simply to get the controversy over with in some cases. But conservative Democrats, and there were many of them, especially in the South at the time, began to line up with the few remaining Republicans to try to defeat this bill. And they did in the end. And what had begun as a battle between Roosevelt and the Supreme Court over the fate of the New Deal then shifted to a pitch battle between Roosevelt and the Congress over which of those two branches would be dominant. So it was a terrific battle, and it occupied the country like nothing since the League of Nations fight, and ultimately wounded Roosevelt politically very badly.
I was going to say it was definitely a big defeat for Roosevelt at the time, but eventually the court began to change, right?
Well, what's interesting is that the court begins to change in the middle of this fight, and that is one of the kind of thrilling twists and turns to this whole drama, is that 2-3 months into the fight, the Supreme Court suddenly begins to uphold liberal pieces of legislation. There was a swing man on the court, as we have today, and his name was Owen Roberts, and he had generally sided with the conservatives, but suddenly he began to side with the liberals. So similar cases that had been knocked down the year before were suddenly being upheld. And so in that way, the legs were being pulled out from under Roosevelt's court packing plan. There seemed to be no need now to pack the court if they were going to pass these decisions. But Roosevelt, by this point, had really committed to the fight. And he felt that if he pulled back, then it would be a sign of weakness and the Congress would have won something significant. So he really dug in his heels and continued to fight. Leaders of the Democratic Party who wanted this just done and just to move on with all the other priorities of the country went to the president and said, look, we can work out a compromise. We can get you four new justices or maybe two new justices, but not all six. Can you not back down just a little bit? But Roosevelt felt that any capitulation would be a sign of weakness. And so he continued to fight to the end. But the justification seemed to have been removed. And then really the coup de grace was delivered by one of the conservative justices, Willis Vandevanter, who had been on the court since 1910, I believe. And Vandevanter, again in the middle of this, announced that he was going to retire, which would tip the balance in the direction of the liberals. He had wanted to retire for a long time, but this was a kind of self-sacrifice. He saw that the gig was up on the court and in terms of its decisions, and he felt that by removing himself, he would kill the court packing plan, and he did indeed contribute to that.
You know, I think what I like most about your book is, I mean, you know what happens at the end, even before you start reading it, but I remember getting so absorbed in it, and so it was just so exciting that I was almost trying to predict what would happen next, even though on retrospect, I knew what was going to happen, but it was written in such a way that it was just like a mystery novel, it's a great book, Jeff.
Well, thank you, Ken. I appreciate that. I really wanted to slow time down a little bit so that you could see this drama evolve, because as I said, there were many twists and turns, and we look back, we know what happened. We know that this is deemed a disaster. We know that he lost, and we might tend to assume without thinking it that it was doomed from the start, but one of the things that I tried to show is that it was actually very close. It was closely fought right down to the end, and as I indicated, if Roosevelt, even just a couple of weeks before the fight was over, if he had yielded, then we would have had a Supreme Court of 13 instead of 15 justices. We'd have 13 on the court today, and we probably wouldn't think anything of it. We'd be so used to it 80 years on.
Jeff Schessel is the author of Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court. He's also the author of Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and The Feud That Defined a Decade, also a great book. Jeff, thanks for making this story come alive for us.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks very much.
Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. And, by the way, since we've been talking about independence a lot on this show, we'd like to remind you that The Political Junkie is an independent production, and we rely on your contributions to keep it going. Please consider donating to the show at krpoliticaljunkie.com/donate. And if you already contribute to the program, thank you so much for your continued support. We couldn't survive without you. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Not in a shy way. Oh, no. Oh, no, not me. I did it my way. For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself.